Hi everyone, you're listening to Beyond the Benchmark, the EFG podcast. My name is Moz Afzal, I'm the Global Chief Investment Officer for EFG. So today we have our quarterly market insight review. I have the Macro A team here again to take us through the insights. So for those of you who are new to this, we have our Insight quarterly market review that you can download from the EFG website. And on that PDF, there is a little microphone that you can click into and you can click into lots of previous insights, quarterly market reviews as well. So we hope you enjoy it. This is a bit of a behind the scenes review of the quarterly market review. And I'm going to start with Paul, who helps us put this together. So Paul, just to quickly go over the overview, and I guess probably the most important development over the last 6 months or so was the Powell pivot.
The Powell pivot. And you, well, three, four months ago, that was what everyone was talking about. And you think, well, that meant that interest rates were going to come down, but now we're in a situation, it's the first chart in this overview. Interest rate expectations for the end of 24 and the end of 25 are higher than they were even before Powell spoke. And, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, everything seemed to hinge on what the Fed was going to do. And it's not been a disaster, far from it. Equity markets have done very well. Treasury bond yields are higher, but the high yield and corporate bond markets have done rather well. No panic, you know. So why was everything really hinging on that? And the way we've structured is to talk about a new reality with a lady wearing sort of some VR headset on the front of the front cover of the publication. And I say, well, there are four main things here. We've got used to higher real rates, which have settled around about 2% for across the maturity spectrum. The US is the absolute leader in terms of economic growth. And we've looked at Bloomberg consensus forecast. Basically, the US growth expectations just go up and growth everywhere in the advanced economies just goes down. That's the second element of the new reality. Third element is fiscal support remains. Now, we've had quite a lot of people recently saying, oh, the size of the US fiscal deficit is just a tragedy sort of waiting to happen, but doesn't seem it's going to have any correction. And the way I tend to think about that is, last time, you know, we had a big problem in the world economy, global financial crisis. You must correct the sort of fiscal position, and debt levels are far too high and will be in all sorts of difficulties if debt exceeds 90 or 100% of GDP. Well, it's simply not happened anywhere apart from Germany. And it doesn't look as though there's going to be any tightening up of the fiscal position anywhere. And the fourth point, probably the most important one, I think, is that world economy seems to have been very resilient. I heard Kristalina Georgieva, a lovely lady, great personality, very energetic, talk in May last year, and she said world trade disruption, which we're all worried about at the time, could knock 7% off world GDP. And we all went, oh, gosh, that sounds terrible. Nothing remotely like that has happened. We've got data on world growth and world production and world trade from this Dutch organization that monitors it very closely. Nothing. I mean, we're not growing very fast, but there's no great sort of disruption. And there are lots of reasons why there could have been disruption, you know, problems in the Red Sea and sort of all sorts of geopolitical sort of problems, but it's just not happened. And at the same time, although we're a bit worried about oil prices recently, there's been no great sort of inflationary threat. So those four key elements, I think, more powerful in many ways than anything the Fed has said or not done on interest rates.
Yeah, I can think, certainly back all of that up, that, I guess, relatively benign view with credit spreads, the VIX, all of those have been very tight and very, very well behaved in an election year, which is also something that is certainly quite unusual. I think there's an interpretation, certainly even from ourselves, is that at some point volatility is going to come, but we're all kind of waiting for it. And the real difficulty, certainly for money managers in this environment, is the markets could be higher another 5 or 10% before you even notice or before that volatility hit. So it is a little bit challenging from an investment perspective to try and get those, although quite frankly prefer benign conditions than the volatile conditions. Certainly that's for sure. I want to pick up on something which I think is quite important, is on the fiscal side. And you've got Great Charles's figure four, which is on sort of general government debt. And the US is obviously up there, we're alongside sort of Italy and Japan. The key thing I always wonder in these sort of situations is kind of the net foreign asset position. So essentially, do you have the ability to pay the debt if you are asked to pay it immediately, or from a country perspective? And the US is probably challenged on that in that environment compared to both Italy and Japan, who basically have pretty strong net foreign asset positions. And in fact, they are in pretty healthy condition on that basis relative to the United States.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's, US has got a terrible net foreign asset position. But the, you know, there's this old story, isn't there, about the dark matter. What's missing in the global financial world is that sort of somehow the UK, the US still manages to have sort of net foreign income from its overseas assets. So it still manages to do that, even though it's got a bad net foreign asset position. Answer is that there are all sorts of ways the US earns money from its overseas assets. Basically, at the simplest, it's running a giant hedge fund because it pays people, say, 4% on 10-year treasury bonds, but it earns a lot more on its overseas assets in terms of direct investment, other portfolio investment. So it's actually, the US is a successful hedge fund. But, you know, successful hedge funds sometimes go bust. But for the time being, it looks as though it's okay. Although its net foreign asset position, as you absolutely rightly say, looks vulnerable.
It is quite interesting. And I think this is where I think the political situation gets interesting. Because if you have a Trump White House, which I've seen latest odds have actually changed quite dramatically in Biden's favour. But thinking about his policies, or the policies that Trump is famous for, is exactly the opposite to that. In terms of a much more insular US economy, and you know, taking away all the foreign wars and everything else that the US is involved in, it could well be the problem that's created.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that's a big uncertainty, of course, isn't it? But I mean, it seems as though it's the old sort of policies, rekindled. So. Big border customs duties and low taxes, and certainly the low taxes don't look anything that's in line with correcting this government debt position.
Absolutely. Anyway, these are sort of medium to long-term challenges that we will no doubt discuss over the coming years. But the overall message is a relatively benign environment, which are typically good for risk assets, and certainly that's what we've seen so far this year.
Yeah, and the benign environment is, I think, we carried that theme on throughout the sort of publication, and it's got three layers, really. It's demographics, US does sort of very well. It's productivity sort of enhancement, which the US does very well, and a sort of more, you know, market-friendly environment. US does that very well, much better than other countries.
Absolutely. I did see that US equity markets, market capitalization hit an all-time peak.
Absolutely.
that certainly may well keep on going for the time being. It certainly seems that way. And then on the next section, we go through asset market performance. We won't repeat that. Generally, equities up, fixed income flat to down, credit up, and currencies, I would say, relatively benign, actually. It doesn't mean huge amount of currency volatility other than, say, a bit of yen and Swiss franc, which are, you know, are carry trade currencies these days.
Yep.
So, Daniel, moving over to the United States section. This is page 5 in the Insight document. We have a bit of a discussion around immigration as well as its impact on wage growth.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting in the current environment is that despite really strong labour markets, we haven't seen the sort of explosive wage growth that some people have been expecting. And one of the ways that you can explain that is it appears that immigration has been underestimated. And so that the fact we had a larger inflow of people is supporting the labour market and dampening wage pressures. And I think that's a really important dynamic and something that, you know, obviously is very beneficial to the US economy, allows it to grow faster without generating worrying price gains. So I'm sure the Fed will be looking at that as well and take some reassurance.
And in terms of the immigration stats we have specifically on page, on slide 11, actually, what are your thoughts around this impact? Because it's very unusual relative to everywhere else in the world where we've seen population declines or fears of that. But in the United States, they've been able to just attract 3.5 million people who want to get there. And quite frankly, they have the land and agriculture to support them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Obviously, US very rich in natural resources, relatively closed economy. Doesn't, it could be self-sufficient if it had to be in most things. So very attractive place for immigrants to aim for. Just to sort of put this in context, without any immigration at all, US labor force is growing at a rate that, would sustain around about in equilibrium, about 100,000 new jobs a month. Current rates of immigration, that rises to more like sort of 250,000 a month. So it's a really meaningful impact at current rates. Now, it's not clear if the current rates will continue and definitely into the future, but certainly it's very helpful in terms of being able to sustain strong growth without it generating a sort of wage price spiral.
I guess you can regard this as a bit of a supply shock, suddenly you've got, all of this extra labour coming in and really pushing on the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, in very simple terms, there's, two things that drive growth. One is the rate of growth of your labour force, and the other is the greater growth in the output, i.e. the productivity. And clearly, US, for the sorts of reasons that Paul highlighted earlier, the US has a very flexible economy and it's heavily steeped in technology, in particular AI, and these sorts of factors are helping the US lead in the developed world in terms of productivity gains. And you combine that with immigration, and actually I think that's very helpful to the US economy.
In the last section, we talked a little bit about kind of fiscal spending. Obviously, we touched upon this a little bit earlier. One thing that doesn't get as much attention, basically because it's not as sexy, is basic tax receipts. So this is the revenue you generate from tax. And obviously, right about now, the Americans will be filing their taxes and paying their taxes. And obviously, given the strong capital gains positions from last year, it's kind of view that this will start to look a little bit better. Any thoughts around the revenue side rather than, simply the spending side?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if an economy is growing faster than expected, if there are more people employed than was previously expected, then tax revenues are going to be higher than expected. And whilst the US is, I think it's going to be difficult for the US to run a balanced budget this year, nonetheless, the revenue side is, has a potential to be much better than expected. If you've got 3.8% unemployment rate instead of a 5% unemployment rate, then obviously your tax revenues are going to be that much higher. So yeah, hugely beneficial.
So it reminds me of the times when we started our careers, mid-90s, when we were just starting to hit the home run on that, right? Remember, I recall the Federal Reserve, well, actually the government was even going to cancel issuance of 30-year bonds because they didn't need them.
No, exactly. And I think, I think that's going to be a key question for the US and the curve next year is exactly where does Yellen decide to issue? We know that, last year Yellen took a decision to issue more at the short end of the curve, and that, for sure impacted the dynamics within the Treasury market. So I think it'll be very interesting to see where and how the US decides to fund its deficit.
And all those big money market mutual fund holdings around the world, no doubt. Thanks, Daniel. Let's move on to Joaquin to talk about the UK. Surprisingly bullish UK data. Not something we're familiar with.
Yeah, that's right. I think we haven't been bullish on the UK for a while. But yeah, inflation in the UK is expected to get close, but not 2% this year. And then this will allow the Bank of England to cut rates at some point in the second quarter or the beginning of the third quarter of this year. Still out there, whether it will be August or whether it will be June with some of the other developed market central banks. But yeah, this will also have a positive impact, as you were just alluding to the revenue side of the government. It's expected that income tax receipts are going to increase by over 11% this year, given that some of these thresholds for income, personal income tax, have been frozen for some time, whereas they used to be adjusted by inflation. Therefore, this will have a positive impact as well on government finances, which is a very welcome indicator. But still, there's still some problems there in the UK economy that maybe they will need to be addressed by the next administration.
Mm-hmm. So retail sales, obviously the sore point at this point in time. Obviously, rate cuts would certainly help. Changing government might help as well.
Yes, definitely. That this will help. I mean, consumption in the UK is also like a massive part of UK GDP. And when you look at the picture on the real terms, which is shown on chart 15 of the pack, you'll see that it's really pointing a picture for economic stagnation for the country. So therefore, yes, this will probably start to, these better inflation numbers will start to help on the consumption side.
And we also touch upon the demographics and the immigration aspects, obviously a highly populous topic in the UK as well as elsewhere. But the trends are probably not what we would expect post-Brexit.
Yeah, I'd say you would expect to see a decline in immigration, but the numbers have shown the complete opposite. I think some of the policies enacted by Sunak government is not going to really solve the problem of shortages that the country has in some key sectors. Maybe getting closer to the EU in terms of trade, in terms of mobility of people, making it easier for some of the workers that used to come pre-Brexit to the UK will probably help that part of the demographic side of the UK. But it's still to be seen. I don't think that illegal migration is the key problem of the job market here.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, let's move on to Eurozone shores. So, Stefan, welcome. Obviously, better inflation data out of Europe, and ECB certainly seems to be on track to cut rates in June, following their colleagues in Switzerland. Your thoughts, Stefan?
So I think this is something that we can expect to see in the euro area. The ECB will cut interest rate. Inflation is coming down. And I think there is a risk that it may fall too low if the euro area were to slip into a recession. And parts of the euro area arguably isn't in a recession, but if that was to get worse, then there is a risk that they would run too low of an inflation, and that's plainly not something they'd like to be, a situation they would like to return to.
We give a little explanation in looking at sort of Eurozone wage growth, which obviously has been kind of relatively muted compared to some of the other locations in the world. How much of a driver do you think that is in terms of the ECB's thinking?
So I think this is really a key question, and it's just another version of sort of what comes first, the chicken or the egg, if you like. If you go back 20 years, the question was, does money growth, is that an indicator of future inflation? Or does money growth simply reflect inflation as we have seen, already? And I think this is exactly the same question now. Is wages an indicator of future inflation? Or does it merely reflect the inflation that and the loss of purchasing power that workers have experienced. So that is really the key question here. Well, how should we interpret this money growth? I think the ECB, or the governing council at least, take the sort of the, they'd rather be safe than sorry. They see this as a driver of inflation. But at the same time, central banks publish research papers that says the opposite, says essentially high wage growth is merely a reflection of high past inflation. Workers have lost purchasing power and they would like to be compensated for it. ECB is playing it safe, and I think that's probably a good thing. You don't know exactly what happened here in the last couple of years, so why not just err on the side of caution and really stare hard on wage growth and don't cut interest rate until it comes down. It makes sense, I think.
The other thing we talk about is obviously productivity in the Eurozone, and then I guess alongside that, the immigration situation is completely opposite in some respect to the US, where we continue to have challenges on the demographic side. But what are your thoughts on in terms of productivity, and then maybe just two seconds on fiscal situation?
So here, I mean, if you look at the graph, the graph 18, figure 18, the euro area looks much worse than the US. But I think there is a risk of misinterpreting these data. Labor hoarding is much more common in Europe. Firms don't fire workers in a downturn, and they don't really hire them as much in an upturn as in the US. So that means that the level of productivity, if the labor force is relatively constant over time and doesn't move very much from quarter to quarter, then productivity will be very pro-cyclical. So in a situation of weakness, like now, it would look like productivity is very low. If you look, for instance, 2020, the euro area had a very negative productivity development. That's probably because the firms did not adjust employment. So it's quite possible here that the low productivity growth you've seen here in the recent past simply is a reflection of the cyclical weakness of the European economy. And this may go away if the European economy recovers. So I think there's a little bit of a risk of overinterpreting this productivity data. Of course, productivity growth in Europe will be lower than in the US, but I don't think it will be zero as it has been here in the last couple of years, according to this graph. So I think we should be a little bit more hopeful. Fiscal policy, of course, is the big issue in Europe. And I'm sort of wondering, there is a need for more spending now most recently on defense. And one sort of wonders whether these fiscal rules, both the European-wide fiscal rules and the German fiscal rules, and indeed actually in Switzerland, the Swiss fiscal rules, one sort of wonder what would happen to these rules as they collide with reality. I think it's difficult to imagine a massive expansion of defense spending in Europe. People talking about countries moving from 2 to 3% of GDP spent on defense. It's a little bit hard to imagine this happening, and they're just cutting spending elsewhere. So we have to see what happens, but plainly tight fiscal policy is something that I think holds Europe back right now.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I think, for me, if the defense spending is leads to very, a secure Europe and the viability of Europe in the long term, they're going to spend the money. And I think I don't think there's any doubt to that. And I think that that is very interesting. And certainly Macron is pushing on that one probably the hardest, more than anyone else. Thanks very much, Stefan, for that. Gianluigi, let's move over to Switzerland. And again, congrats to actually both you and Stefan for getting that SMB call right in terms of the interest rate cut. I think this certainly has had quite a big influence, and a very interesting influence also for the rest of Europe, and what and kind of sets up the ECB to cut, essentially. Your thoughts on that, and what's going on with Swiss inflation?
Well, first thing to note is that By cutting rates before other major central banks, the Swiss National Bank once again, establish its independence, if anyone in the markets had doubt about it. Then, of course, the decision reflected the overall macroeconomic environment, where, and particularly the fact that inflation has returned within the 0 to 2% target for a few months now, and it actually drifted not only below what the S&P itself had expected, but also kind of dangerously towards the low end of the range. And that, of course, raises the risk of it exiting from the range, from to the downside. And that justifies a looser monetary policy. And indeed, the data that were released after the monetary decision in March just confirmed that indeed this, the outlook for inflation and to some extent also activity in Switzerland remains pretty weak. And hence there is room for further rate cuts before the end of the year, possibly as early as June, if inflation continues to drift lower as it did for the first 3 months of the year.
And in terms of the rate cut itself, how was that welcomed in Switzerland itself, you know, from industries and others, I guessing a pretty positive viewpoint, or was it taken in a much more negative way?
No, the reaction was, I think, positive, not last because it sparked some weakening in the Swiss franc, which was a major concern for a number of enterprises, particularly those more exposed to export markets and foreign demand. The weakness of the Swiss franc made it be a bit exaggerated, but we know that markets tend to kind of overshoot. But it was definitely welcomed by firms, which had indeed in the past suffered, and particularly towards the end of last year when the Swiss franc appreciated pretty quickly and possibly too quickly. And so that was overall welcome. And it was also well explained by the central bank why they did it. And as long as interest rates remain positive, there is and there will always be, backing to the Swiss National Bank actions from the Swiss public.
Now, the last part of the page, I think, is very interesting around the public pensions and the vote for more pensions. I think is one of those things. If most people had the opportunity to vote, they'd probably vote the same thing. But there's some cost to this. And could even be considered a bit of an own goal from a Swiss competitiveness perspective. But what are your thoughts on this? And I think they're quite well, relayed in the paragraph.
Well, indeed, I personally think it risks being indeed a bit of an own goal, as you said, because that extra pension expenditure will need to be funded one way or another. And although it's only, quote unquote, between 4 and 5 billion Swiss francs initially, which is about 0.5% of GDP, it still goes in the wrong direction. Another, I would say, more effective way to tackle the issue would have been to raise pension age, because that would have allowed to increase the pension that people once retired would earn, and then tackle the situation of possibly, households not, meeting the ends at the end of the month. Eventually, there is a risk that social contributions and indirect taxes or direct taxes will be raised. And that, although only marginally, could dent, Swiss competitiveness on foreign markets. And that is definitely not something that the Swiss economy would not want to see, because it's a small open economy, of course, dependent a lot on its export competitiveness.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and something I think is quite interesting in whether the Swiss franc has already started to very early days reflect some of that noise that's created. I doubt too much that people are too bothered about it. It's probably purely focused on the interest rates. But I think this is something to certainly take good note of, and it was a good piece. I thought a very interesting piece on some of those own goal aspects. So thank you very much, Gianluigi. So let's move on to Asia and to Sam, and we talk about the comparison that actually most people make is between China and India, both kind of very large economies. India's trying to play catch up. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I guess it's interesting. There's a lot of similarities you can draw between them, but also a lot of important differences. And, you know, looking at chart 24, where we show the GDP per capita as a percentage of the US level, I think there's two ways to read it, which one is to see the potential in that both have a long way to play catch up. And the other way is kind of the less optimistic view is, wow, both have a really long way to go to get there. And, you know, one of Narendra Modi's kind of aims for 2047, which is India's 100-year anniversary of independence, is to make India a developed economy. And look at this chart here, the GDP per capita would have to roughly triple to do that. So it really is a long way to go. And yeah, it's an optimistic target at best.
Yeah. And I think you then sort of talk a little bit about China's low confidence and India's hype. Obviously, India's certainly hyped at the moment. I think most kind of medium to long-term investors are pretty bullish on the prospects, and I don't think there's any reason to doubt that. But what are the contrasts between the two? It's suddenly China off the boil and India's hyping. I guess over the last 20 years, it's been the other way around.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, I think chart 25 kind of highlights that China has a surplus in the private sector of savings as a percentage of its GDP. And it kind of started spiking around 2014, which is around the same time the private sector's share of total investments started falling. And that's mostly been due to the property market, which then links on to the consumer confidence in China, because a lot of consumer wealth in China is tied up in real estate. And with falling property prices, it's kind of natural then that actually your confidence starts to fall. You have rising unemployment in China as well, and kind of social welfare and social safety nets not really in place. So it'd be good to see some policies that support that. India, on the other hand, you know, you have consumer confidence actually at the highest level since kind of mid-2019. Investments picked up, and, you know, there's a lot of policies by Modi that are really pushing the manufacturing side, such as the production-linked incentive scheme, and that gives out financial incentives to boost manufacturing. That was set to end in 2025, but has been extended. It looks like Modi is about to be elected again for another term, probably, I think, in June is the election date. And he has this kind of plan that's the Make in India plan, which is part of his self-reliant India policy. So he wants manufacturing to account for 25% of GDP in 2025, and still some way to go to get there. So his kind of plan is to lure manufacturers to India with tax cuts and, you know, capital supports. And we've recently seen reports that Tesla's been scouting a site in India, looking to build a car plant there for around, I think, $3 billion, I noted, and, you know, maybe compete with China there.
Yeah, certainly would be interesting. We also then touch upon Japan, and the recovery story remains pretty bullish, I would say, kind of medium to long term. Certainly a lot of commentators have relatively extreme positions on Japan, I think, and the Waze data certainly is moving in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly. I guess kind of one of the most notable things of Q1 was the Bank of Japan ended its negative interest rate policy, which we kind of always said could happen. And what the Bank of Japan was looking for, as Stefan noted earlier, is do wage increases come first or does inflation come first? The Bank of Japan's been talking about this virtuous cycle between services prices and wage growth. And essentially, we had those services prices increasing, and the 2024 Shinto wage round increases, they showed that wage increases for this year were the highest for 33 years. So that definitely supports kind of consumer demand, particularly for the services sector, which Japan hasn't really seen for quite a long time, and definitely supports the bull case on that market.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much, Sam. So let's moving on to LATAM. And I guess the fight against inflation seems to be returning, Joaquin.
Yeah, so it seems to have worked in part of the region. With we've seen the examples of Brazil, Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Peru, all of them having success at reducing inflation by increasing rates quite early in the cycle, and now most of them are now in easing mode. But I mean, that positive story, you would say, is still markets have not really reacted at the beginning of this year as expected to some of these positive economic news, in particular in Brazil. I think the volatility within some of the stocks in the index, mostly attributed to the risk of more political intervention in some of the key government-owned companies. And so that is kind of being a problem for them. But then, you know, progress has been made more on the fiscal side, which is going to be very, very gradual this year. And I guess those are part of the challenges we're going to see for this year.
So we touch on, of course, a topic we have talked before is Milei and what's going on in Argentina. I guess we continue to watch that with interest. I think now comes the business end of trying to implement the talk. So I guess we need to walk the talk, or he has to, at least anyway. And then we have Mexican elections later in the year, which is also going to see some kind of interesting developments.
Yeah, that's right. So Mexican elections, I think that's Mexico continues to benefit from the nearshoring policies with a very, very good numbers of foreign direct investment there. The election will bring the first female president to the country, which is going to be a very, very interesting development. And as you were making reference to Milei in Argentina, yeah, I think on paper, when you look at a president that wants to reduce, to cut spending, to reduce inflation, to reduce red tape, it all looks like very good, very positive ideas. The problem is, how do you implement this in a very polarized country? So I think I'm less optimistic on the success for him.
Exactly. So we'll certainly take a look at when that time arrives. So then we move on to the last section of the piece, which is the end of the ice age. So this is not reference to prehistoric history, but cars and electric cars. Paul?
Yeah, well, it's got a question mark. End of the ice age, question mark. ICE, internal combustion engine. So I know this is one of your favourite, do I call it a water cooler conversation in EFG? You seem to know everyone seems to talk about it. And, you know, the stories about rapid depreciation and you've still got an ICE and it's better off not to have an EV. And I hear all of those sorts of things. So we were trying to sort of make some story out of this. I must say it's about the end of the ice age, but I should tell you first off that I recently experienced ice rage. I was in California, some with an internal combustion engine, BMW, quite a nice car, big car, an old car. The average age of US cars is apparently 13 years. And he parked at 90 degrees to the EV charging stations, blocking out three EVs from charging. So that's ice rage. I don't like these EVs, and I really, you know, it's something to be resisted. Anyway, we know that sales have fallen off a little bit recently, but I drew out an old chart, which actually originally came from the IMF. And it was, well, what happened in the early 1900s when we stopped using horses and mules and had motor cars? And the rise of the motor car was very rapid, and the decline of the horses and mules was, you know, equally rapid. Has a trajectory of EVs followed the motor car in the early 1900s? Answer, yes, just about. So we're now up to 4 million motor cars in the sort of US, for example. So it's followed that. So talk of slowing sales sort of recently, but it looks pretty much following that sort of trajectory. But we know there are a number of problems that have arisen. Mose, you've sort of identified many of these. So the high prices and then the rapid depreciation of EVs. I think for the second one, the rapid depreciation, there's a silver lining in many ways, because we know that a large part of the purchase price, the cost of an EV, is the battery. And the chart that we've got on figure 32 on lithium-ion battery prices, it's from Bloomberg New Energy Finance. I think it's a really interesting series. Shows the massive decline in battery prices. So, yeah, you've got depreciation in EV prices. But the silver lining is that actually that's because the battery cost is sort of coming down. We hear stories about high insurance costs. But we've all heard the story about the amount of data generated by EVs and how that makes sort of calculation of insurance premiums easier and sort of more targeted and so on. So I think that sort of problem could also be overcome as well. And then the environmental credentials. Well, EVs are great, but only if you're using electricity from renewable sources, and that might not always be possible. I know it's a point that Pierre Ferrigo often makes about sort of EVs. And I don't know. I tend to think in this respect that some of these problems are a little bit like the problems associated with smartphones. I was going to call them iPhones, but I corrected myself. In their early days, you know, it was all about, oh, the battery doesn't last sort of very long, and oh, this is going to be worthless in 18 months and so on. But technological improvement means, it doesn't mean that we don't have smartphones. Everyone has a smartphone now, just about. So I tend to think of it more like that. And of course, the development of the internal combustion engine itself was an evolutionary one. A car now is very different to probably most the first car you drove. I'm trying to think what year it might be, but it's sometime in the 80s, maybe.
I'm not saying
anything. You're not saying anything, but I imagine it's very different. And so technological improvement can take us a long way. So my conclusion is, yes, of course, there are negatives now, especially in depreciation and declining prices and declining sales and so on. But I think that's just part of a story which will be an evolution towards the EV age and the end of the ice age. But it'll take a long time.
Yeah, I think so. I think ice age will probably continue, but just be like specialist vehicles that will be out there.
Yeah.
And I guess just thinking about this a little bit more, over the last few years, obviously technology has advanced. The Chinese manufacturer seems to be much more aggressive than many of their manufacturers were. And I think, Elon Musk and Tesla's kind of long-term view is there's a little value left in the car itself.
Yep.
But in the end, it is all about the software and being driverless and so on and so forth. That actually is where the intellectual property actually sits for an EV in the future. So, you know, the worst case scenario is potentially printers, where now I remember spending thousands of pounds on a printer.
Yep.
Today, the printer costs nothing, but you pay for the cartridge. You kind of wonder whether that kind of model for EVs is where we end up, in sort of 15 or 20 years' time.
And for a smartphone, it's your contract. It's not really the hardware cost any longer. It's the contract and everything that runs on it and the sort of software associated with it. So maybe that is the right sort of model. The hardware is not so important any longer.
Yeah. That will be very depressing for all those petrol heads who look for very nice looking cars. But thank you, Paul, for taking the time to do that. I think it's an interesting topic. It's a good idea to kind of think longer term is exactly where this will end. Obviously, it could create a lot of value for car companies who can actually be the software engineers for the future.
Absolutely.
Certainly, as we've seen, Microsoft and Google and even Apple with its hardware and software model, both being huge companies. And you've got to wonder whether the EV world eventually looks like a software company rather than a hardware company, or certainly some parts of it are sort of manufactured by, a version of TSM. And yep. all of the real value added is in the software. But I guess we shall see.
And BYD, of course, stands for build your dreams. I mean, it is dreaming of an EV.
Could well be. I have to say, I can't do that just yet. Okay. Right. With that, Paul, thank you very much. And thank you very much for listening in to Beyond the Benchmark, the quarterly insight version. We'll be back. And if you've got any questions, please feel free to drop them into the macro team. So with that, thank you very much. And we'll speak to you again soon.